This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Thanks very much, Jameen, for inviting me months and months ago when he invited me. I'm actually a recent addition to the program, which is great because I'm... My topic, I think, is a good follow-up to what Dr. Oda was talking about. And that's, I'll just start out actually with something entertaining that happened to me a few years ago when I was in Egypt, where I won't be going anytime soon. And I was walking along the sidewalk, and I found, these sidewalk book markets, and there was a great book there that said, the title was Zawaj al-Mutahala. Of course, I immediately bought the book, and I had my collection of books on this topic in my office, and I found another book nearby. It says, Zawaj al-Mutahharam for the Qur'an wa Sunnah. So there was a rebuttal to that book. The main argument in the Mutah Marriages Halal book was that the companion, Ibn Abbas, had, depending on who you believe, either for a time or for his entire life, he believed that Zawaj Mutah marriage was halal. So you actually had this very esteemed companion of the Prophet who held that Mutah marriage was acceptable in Islam. Obviously, this is not popular amongst the other Sunni schools of law, amongst all the Sunni schools of law. So that's one example. I want to mention another example as well, also involving Ibn Abbas. And this is the question of the threefold divorce. So if a man says to his wife, "Anti talak, anti talak, anti talak, you're divorced, you're divorced, you're divorced," all the four Sunni schools of law say that that woman is immediately and irrevocably divorced. Ibn Taymiyyah famously disagreed with this, and his argument for why this should only count for one of the three divorces and should not be irrevocable was that, first of all, he believed that this was the spirit of the Quran. He believed that this was the way that the Prophet had prescribed the practice of divorce, which is true according to Hadiths. And finally, he said this is the ruling of Ibn Abbas. So here you have two different opinions, one of which people in Egypt would find despicable, or namely the Mutah marriage ruling. The other one that is actually became the basis for a lot of modern divorce law in Muslim countries. So the Ottoman Family Law of 1917 and many other law codes after that, partially based on that, actually take Ibn Taymiyyah's ruling for the triple divorce, making a three declarations of divorce in one session only equal to one declaration of divorce. I think, and I'm sure lots of people agree, that that's actually a very good rule to take, and it actually does promote the welfare of Muslims. So what you have here is a great example of a tension, which is that the diversity of the Islamic legal heritage, especially in its early period, is both a tremendous resource, it's a blessing, in that it gives Muslims a giant toolkit, or the analogy I like to use for my students, a Mr. Potato Head bucket of parts, a giant bucket of parts you can draw from, to solve the problems of Muslims, and to promote Muslims' best interests, legitimately. Of course, as you saw with the case of Ibn Abbas and Mutah marriage, it's also a risk. The diversity of the Islamic legal tradition is a liability, it's a risk, it's a temptation, because just as one can promote the advancement or protection of Muslim interests using it, one can also allow or excuse illegitimate desires, your ahwa, your desires, your different agendas, exploitation, using this. And that's what's usually referred to as tatabbu' ar-rukhas, or following the different licenses or dispensations. And a good example of this comes from the scholar originally from Basra, he moved to Sana'a, Ma'mar bin Rashid, died 153 Hijri, who said that if you take the opinion of the people of Mecca in Mutah marriage and Sarf, which is kind of exchanging monies, and you take the opinion of the people in Medina on anal sex and listening to music, you take the opinion of the people of Kufa on intoxication, you'll be shar'i bi'ad Allah. You'll be the worst person of all human beings, the worst of God's creation. So this was the big fear, is that Muslims are going to cobble together a sharia out of all the different odd licenses or anomalous, weird opinions that they find in the legal heritage, and end up with a really, really terrible version of Islam, which no one would accept, but which is actually technically legitimate in the sense that it comes out of this historical heritage. How the way that Muslim scholars dealt with this tension, how to avoid the take advantage of its good sides without falling into too many of its liabilities, is through several methods. One is to talk about intentions. Second is to try and actually set up some procedural restrictions. The third one is to set a set of qualifications. And the fourth one, and this is not really something they thought of, I think, but it's something that we have to look at as inevitable, ineluctable, is that this is also always going to be subject to political considerations. It's always going to be subject to political considerations, by which I mean people's interests, the interests of the powerful, the interests of regnant cultural ideas, the interests of what people are drawn to in their daily lives. So you can never, this also has a huge influence over what's a legitimate choice and what's an illegitimate choice in terms of drawing on this legal heritage. Muslim scholars had to look at this from two perspectives. The first was in their capacity as judges. For my students who've had to sit through me talking about this before, I apologize. That's primarily Mirva and Tuba over there. We have to remember that Muslim scholars aren't just intellectuals. They're not just people who talk about what's ethical and what's good for you. They also served as judges. And so they really had to make sure that they were establishing a legal order that was workable, at least on a local level, and it was consistent and unified at a theoretical global level. By the 1200s, what had basically emerged, whether you're talking about North Africa, which is obviously al-Maliki, or Central Asia, or Iran, or the Arabian Peninsula, is that if you had an area with one dominant school of law like Maliki North Africa, judges would, either by decree of the ruler or pretty much most of the time by their own kind of peer pressure, they would be expected to rule by what's called the mashur of the madhhab, the main opinion or the primary opinion of the school of law. If you were a senior judge, you would have more latitude in taking from other rulings in that one madhhab. If you were in an area where I should specify something else. There was also times, especially in the Hanafi school of law, we see this a lot in the Ottoman Empire, in the Indian Mughal Empire, which Moiz Khalfoui writes about, that the sultans or the rulers would also specify a specific ruling that was not the main ruling of the madhhab that should be taken. So we have lots of examples of this in the Ottoman Empire, like instead of the main Hanafi ruling, which prohibits making endowments with cash or gold and silver, normally you wouldn't be allowed to do that in the Hanafi school. You could only, in any school actually, you'd have to make an endowment with land or a shop or something like that. Where the Ottoman Sultan said that no, we're going to take the ruling of Zufar, one of Abu Hanifa's early disciples, which says that you in fact can use make cash waqfs. And this was very important because guess what? By that point, in the 1500s, the Ottoman economy, especially its religious economy, medrasas, hospitals, mosques, they were all running off cash waqfs. That's a very good example of how political reality determines what's an acceptable choice. And a lot of scholars, especially non-government associated scholars in the Ottoman Empire, in the 1500s, when this debate happened, people like Pir Ali Birgiwi, who wrote the Tariq al-Muhammadiyya, he really had a lot of severe arguments with the establishment of ulama in the Ottoman Empire, saying you guys are really betraying the legacy of Hanafi school of law and doing what's inappropriate by allowing this. But the political power of the sultan carried the day. So that's in an area where you have one dominant school of law. If you had it in a place like Egypt where you have multiple schools of law coexisting, the Maliki school and the Hanafi school and the Shafi'i school, what you ended up with by the 1200s and 1300s is kind of a systematic telfiq, or a systematic picking and choosing. So it wasn't that people just went to the Hanafi court when they wanted something in the Shafi'i court, and it was just total chaos. It was understood exactly what court you were supposed to go to for certain issues. So if you wanted to tear down a mosque that was endowed by a waqf, you can't really tear down mosques because they're eternal. You would go to the Hanbali court because the Hanbalis actually allow the government to basically exercise eminent domain and tear down a mosque or a waqf if it's been determined to be decrepit, which is a very subjective decision. So if it was understood precisely which courts you would go to for which issues, it wasn't just legal chaos. But the other dimension, very important dimension of scholars' duties, was not as judges, but as muftis and as advisors and as articulators of Islamic ethics. And by Islamic ethics here, I mean things that aren't going to see the inside of a courtroom. Everything I just talked about was only if you were actually went to a court. For all sorts of things like fasting and prayer and your Hajj and all of these other things, you would never actually be in a court. So when it came to scholars acting as muftis, they also had different approaches to solving this problem or dealing with this tension between Islamic legal diversity as a resource, legitimate resource, versus as a temptation into sin. By the 1200s, what you saw is basically three, and I think really it's emerged in the 1200s, three different approaches to this. The first one we can think of as a very permissive approach, which basically said, you can do fatwa shopping. You, as you know, Ahmed Muslim, can go and just ask any number of muftis you want what their ruling is, and you just take the one you like. And it doesn't matter if you take the easiest one because you're lazy and you want to be able to drink or something like that. This is fine. Why? Because deeds are determined by intentions. If you have bad intentions, God's not going to reward you, or God's going to punish you, even if it's allowed in this life. Second, and this was the biggest argument, that the companions did this. That doesn't mean the companions went around doing awful fatwa shopping. What it means is that they didn't have established madhhabs. They would ask each other about different rulings, and then they would take what they thought was right. So you can't require somebody to follow a certain madhhab because this was not what the companions had done. And you can see in this a very, I'll use the word Salafi because it's useful. It's not, people didn't actually call themselves Salafis. But this idea of using the companions and their conduct really as the defining model for what you can demand of Muslims and expect. So the fact that the companions didn't restrict themselves to any one school of law means that we cannot restrict people today. People have to be free to choose. So that's maybe a very permissive approach. This was, you find this people like Izzaddin ibn Abdissalam, died 1262. Yeah, 1262. And Zarkashi, Muhammad Bahadur Zarkashi, who died in 1394. The second approach is sort of really emerged amongst the Shafi scholars of the Middle East. It was first articulated by people like Ibn Zakiq al-Ayy, died 1302. And Tajuddin al-Subki, and this was that they set up a body of procedures. For example, you could not pick and choose between madhhabs such that the resulting action was unacceptable to the school you were coming from and the school you were going to. What does that mean? Let's say I want to pray, so I do my ablutions. And I only wipe part of my head, which is okay in the Shafi school, and the Hanafi school, and the Hanbali school, not okay in the Maliki school. And then I go and I pet a dog. Hey, dog. And I go and pray. And I say, oh, but the Malikis, they say dogs are not filthy, so it's okay. Well, the Shafis say that the dog is filthy. The Malikis don't accept me wiping half of my head. So I actually put together a Mr. Potato Head that's internally inconsistent. And later on, this list of restrictions gets simpler, and what it says is you can't have a resulting ruling or set of connected rulings that is objectionable or unacceptable to all Muslims. So if you come up with something where you say, I'm going to take the Maliki ruling, which a minority Maliki ruling says I don't have to give my wife a mahar, and I'm going to take the Hanafi ruling, which says I don't need my to ask her the permission of the wali, and I'm going to take this other ruling so they don't need to have witnesses, I basically end up with a marriage with no mahar, no witnesses, and no permission of the wali, which no one is going to accept. Except the young people, probably. Third, some other restrictions that they put in there was that ideally the person doing this, whether it's the lay person who's going and seeking out opinions of muftis, whether it's the muftis themselves giving the ruling, they should do it because they believe this is the strongest opinion. This enjoys the best evidence. or that there is some need involved. So even if it's not the best, strongest opinion by your judgment as a scholar or by your decision as a layperson, there's some need, legitimate need. So it's interesting, here we have to distinguish between need and necessity. And I haven't seen a lot of people who talked about this, although I'm sure I'm missing it. Jalaluddin Suyuti talks about it in Ashbah wa Nadha'if, that necessity, darura, means if you don't do this, you're going to die. Or really close to it, right? So if you are dying of starvation, you can eat a giant pig carcass, or as I always like to make the joke, you know, Joe's Ribs and Bibs shack in the desert. If you're dying of starvation, you can go and eat the pulled pork sandwich. If you're not dying of starvation, but you're really hungry, and it's causing tremendous difficulty and problems for you, that's haja, that's need. So that would mean, for example, you could get permission to break your Ramadan fast. If you're ill, something's wrong with your body, you're just, every day you're miserable because of Ramadan fasting, you might not have to fast Ramadan, according to the Mufti. Or here you might have things like... It would never allow what is prohibited. No school of law says that it's okay to eat pork. So only under darura can you eat pork. But there's lots of disagreement about, let's say, eating alligator. Disagreement about eating alligator. So if you're living in Florida, let's say, a place where people eat, and it's really causing you a lot of problems that you can't eat alligator or sushi at the cafeteria at your work, then you could take the ruling of the Auza'i who allows you to eat alligator meat. So this is, it's not allowing what's prohibited by agreement, but it's allowing you to pick and choose between madhhabs. So that's the kind of, what becomes the middle approach to this issue, and it's very common amongst Shafi scholars in especially the Middle East. The third school is the strictest. This I've found to be the prevalent mostly amongst Hanafis, whether in the Ottoman Empire or in South Asia, which is that really you should follow one school of law. And if you don't know what a school of law is because you're really uneducated, which is fine, then you just follow one authority, your village mufti or somebody, you follow that one person, whatever they do, or whatever they tell you, you do. And you don't go picking and choosing. This is, you find this amongst later Ottoman scholars. You also find this amongst in the Deoband school in the Darul Uloom system in the whole world, the Darul Uloom network. But it's important to note that this is not, this also has an exception. It has an exception in the sense that from the side of the scholar is still able to choose between madhabs in situations of darura, as Rashid Ahmed Gangohi said. I guess Ibrahim Musa is not here. He could talk about Rashid Ahmed Gangohi. But, Rashid Ahmed Gangohi, one of the early Deoband scholars, said that he will take a position from another school of law if it is a necessity. Other Deoband scholars said if there's a strong need or umum al-balwa, something that is causing difficulty for the Muslim community, but they will do that as a scholar issuing a fatwa. It's not up to the layperson to pick and choose between things based on what they feel their needs are. It's up to the scholar in his or her ability as someone drawing on the legal heritage to come up with a ruling to give to those lay people. So that's the most, kind of the strictest approach. I just wanted to talk about two, I think, if I have time, two, but maybe just one case study here, for example, and one has to do with Islamic, listen, we already talk about marriage, we'll keep talking about marriage, which is marriage age. And what is the, can a Muslim government or can Muslim scholars legitimately in Islam say that we can say that it is illegal for a man or woman to marry, let's say, under the age of 16? Why is that a problem? Anybody have a guess? Why is it a problem for a Muslim to say that you cannot marry somebody under the age of 16?
The idea of gulu, isn't it?
It's supposed to be.
Because the Prophet married Aisha when she was 9 or 10 years old.
Arguably.
Arguably. Anyway, all schools of law say that she was 9 or 10 years old, therefore, you're accepted. You, it's, you, you can't go and say what the Prophet did was wrong. It's haram. So how do you do this? When this restriction was first introduced in the Ottoman family law of 1917, and then was followed in places like Egypt and legal reforms in 1923, and in basically every other Middle Eastern country, which it's not true, most of them, up until then. How is this argued? How could you argue this Islamically? One, you wouldn't say this is a statement about what's halal haram. You're saying this is simply the ruler acting in his capacity as an executive and placing an administrative restriction on judges. So if you live in a village and you go out and marry, your 13-year-old daughter gets married to your 13-year-old neighbor's son, and you do a nikah, that's legal in God's eyes. But you can't go to court and register, because the sultan the ruler said that the court can only register marriages to people 16 and over. That's one argument, which is using the executive power of the ruler. The second one is to reach back into that great grab bag of Islamic legal heritage and find, where's the exact part that I need? The Kufan scholar of the 8th century, Ibn Shubrama, who was a contemporary of Abu Hanifa, never had a madhhab, but was a very respected scholar in his day. Ibn Shubrama, supposedly, said that you cannot have any marriage contract for anyone under age. I also want to clarify here. No school of law that I know of, and I've looked at this issue in depth, says you can have sex with someone who's underage. You cannot have sex with someone who is not pubescent. But of course, that's really hard to legislate. You know, you could legislate. It's hard to know when people start puberty. The issue we're talking about here isn't sex, it's the marriage contract. In general, the schools of law in Islam say a marriage contract can be done with someone who's prepubescent. You just can't actually, there can't be consummation of the marriage. So what Ibn Shubrama says is there cannot be any contract at all before the person reaches balugh, before they reach basically physical maturity. So you go back and you reach and you find the position of Ibn Shubrama. Now, why is this problematic? Because what is the correct motive? What is motivating the scholars involved in this discussion? Are the scholars involved in this discussion truly concerned with advancing the welfare of the Muslim community? Are they truly doing what they think God wants of them? Or are they advancing a position that is popular with at that time British supervision of Egyptian public life and its influence on Egyptian values? There was lots of discussion about this in Egypt in the 1920s. There continues to be discussion about it until today, and lots of you don't have to wait very long, maybe just 2 or 3 weeks, I bet, before there'll be something on your Facebook page where some mufti says that it's okay to marry a 12-year-old, and someone will get outraged by that. So there's always a continuous train of outrages over this issue until today. Or are those people, are those scholars arguing from an age restriction, actually coming up with a legitimate opinion, which really does represent the best interest of the Muslim community and what God wants from Muslims in this day and age? And that was the position that was taken by lots of very conservative Muslim scholars in Egypt, people like Sheikh Al-Azhar Abdul Halim Mahmoud, and even Ali Tantawi, who died in 1999, I believe. He's a Syrian scholar who worked as a judge in Damascus courts before the courts were totally secularized in the 1950s, and he later moved to Saudi Arabia. That's more famous for his TV shows. But he also he objected to morally saying that it was wrong to marry someone who was under 16, but he had no problem as a functionary of the state working in a Sharia court applying the ruler's restriction that you not register a marriage for someone who's under 16. The second example I'll give very briefly also actually involves Ibn Shubrama. Ibn Shubrama is this scholar who no one really hears about, But Adli is at the center of two big debates in the modern Islamic thought. One is marriage age restriction. The second is the crucial transaction that allows Muslims to have Islamic mortgages, which is al-bay' al-murabaha bil-amr al-shira, right? So what that means is, I want to buy a house, so I go to the bank and I say, bank, buy this house for me. I will buy it. I promise I will buy it from you over a period of time with an inflated price. That's how you can have an Islamic mortgage. However, the problem is that none of the schools of law allow you to have a sale with conditions. So by saying, buy this for me and I promise I'll buy it from you, you're not allowed to do that. In the sense that that promise is not legally enforceable. It can be morally enforceable. It's not legally enforceable. Except for whom? Ibn Shubrama. Alhamdulillah. Ibn Shubrama said, you can do this. So in 1979, when there's the first international financial conference for Islamic, Tamar al-Awwal al-Masraf al-Islami in Dubai in 1979, they go back and say, Ibn Shubrama's opinion is the one we're going to take. And this allows this. And this has become very important in Islamic finance. But, of course, lots of people objected to this. One, the great originally Palestinian, later resident Kuwait scholar, Suleiman Muhammad al-Ashqar, wrote in an objection to this, that this is absolute perversion of the Islamic legal outlook on this issue. That, in fact, no one really knows what Ibn Shubrama's opinion was. And this is an important issue as well, which is that the problem with taking like companion opinions and people who didn't have madhabs is that we don't really know what their rulings were. We don't really know what Ibn Abbas thought about mutah marriage. There's just reports. We don't really know what Ibn Abbas or what Ibn Shubrama thought about sales and contracts. So we just have a few reports. We don't have a comprehensive school of Ibn Shubrama. It's been looked at generation after generation after generation and checked and rechecked and refined. So that's why all these different approaches I talked about earlier to mixing and mashing between schools of law, it's between established schools of law. They're all very, very skeptical and very suspicious of going back before the schools of law to companions and people like that. You cannot go back and take their rulings because you don't know what their rulings were. You just have these hints, these echoes recorded in history. So the Al-Ashqar criticizes this 1979 Islamic conference ruling on finance. It says this is clearly designed to allow Muslims to participate in a modern financial system which is based on riba, which is unacceptable in Islam. Now, where the truth in that lies, Allahu A'lam. But I think you'll see with those examples of marriage age, with divorce, with muta marriage, with Islamic finance, that on these issues, it's very hard to tell. Is it the best argument that carries the day, or is it what's politically popular? By politically popular, I don't just mean politically within one country. I mean politically amongst Muslims who cannot avoid having their discussions about their religion within the greater hegemonic context of modernity, of globalized Western values. It's very hard to know what really is determining what God wants on any one issue. Thanks very much.